Welcome to Healthy Brain, Happy Body, a podcast from the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. I'm Dr. Saul Rosenthal, a health psychologist in the Boston area, and your host as we investigate the incredible connections between brain and the body. Today, we continue the discussion I had with Dr. Jeff Carman, psychologist and inventor of the PIRHEG neurofeedback system. As an expert on understanding brain-based issues that often lead to changes in behavior, mood, or cognitive status, Jeff has seen many patients referred for anxiety or mood disorder who in fact are suffering from migraine, seizures, or other medical issues. In the last episode, we talked about how those conditions might mimic psychological symptoms. In the second part of our conversation, we consider how healthcare providers can do a better job identifying the issues in order to provide the best treatment.
People need to investigate more when they first meet somebody. I mean, I think there's a laxity in the counseling field where maybe the orientation is one of it must be mental. And there's a real laxity within the biofeedback, neurofeedback field because it's not really oriented towards diagnosis. It's oriented towards fixing things.
I was actually going to ask you about that. Not exactly as you put it, but I like the way you put it, because you really raise a question of, as applied psychophysiologists, if we want to call ourselves that.
I like it.
That's a good term. What can we do better? Because on the one hand, I think being oriented away from diagnosis is a good thing.
Yeah.
Because we can get into we probably would not have much of a debate about the DSM, but right. We can get into a discussion about it. But you're actually raising a really interesting point, which is orienting away from diagnostics and just towards, quote, I'll put quotes around it, fixing things, we may lose something there. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about that.
Well, take the QEEG as an example. Take it away, actually. It's a point in time. So it's affected by lots of different things. But in an office where you're treating people, most times there isn't time to do a lot of them on the same person. That's one of the reasons I leaned in the direction of the infrared imaging. It only takes a few seconds. But with a QEEG, you get a lot of really good data, and you get it once. With disorders related to, well, paroxysmal disorders where they're really very violent, or even just transitory disorders come on, the brain changes during that time. So it'd be much better if you could get the QEEG during one of those events, which is very unlikely. I do like to send people for EEGs. Clinical EEG, if there's suspicion of seizure.
Which is another tough one, because those are often even shorter than QEEGs. I mean, you can get the longer ones, but, you know, I've worked with a lot of people who clearly, you know, and I can see on the QEEG paroxysms, and they go to a neurologist who does, you know, a 5-minute EEG and says there's nothing there.
Yeah, I mean, it's a problem.
Yes.
Maybe the best approach to this is to realize it's a problem and you should remain suspicious in the absence of confirming data.
Mm-hmm. So the absence of evidence is not the evidence of absence. I think Jay Gottman says that a lot.
Exactly.
So if we're sort of too focused on fixing things, we may be missing out on important information. So, you know, relying on QEEGs as a neural feedback practitioner isn't enough, is what
Right. You're
saying.
That's exactly what I'm saying.
And so I think about approaches like the Othmer approach. They rely on symptom checklists, and
Yep.
and other folks do who are who are doing, say, Loretta, I think Loretta neurofeedback often relies as much on the symptom checklist as on the cues. So we should be doing multi-faceted diagnostics. Is that what you're suggesting?
Maybe not. I find stuff like that pretty complicated. When I talk to a new patient, I'm mostly interested in finding out if there are things that they consider unusual or not controllable, and what they might be, and then dive into them, especially things that come and go out of nowhere. And what I find a lot of times is that people are not happy to talk about them unless you target it, because their primary care doctor may think they're crazy. These are weird things that come out of nowhere and then leave. And people generally are very concerned about the possibility that they're going nuts.
But why else would you be seeing the shrink?
Yeah, well, that's true too. But I mean, I tend to be more diffuse on targeting symptoms initially and then narrow it in asking about patterns. The symptom checklists, I don't know, they have a place, but I tend not to use them. Like, one thing I use a lot is clarity of speech articulation. People don't have a good ability to monitor that themselves. And so it's a non-self-monitored behavior that changes with brain function. And you can generally hear a big difference before and at the end of the session. And that's a nice measure that things are going better or worse. So I do use clarity of speech a lot.
Yeah, that's a good one, because I can see even if it's at the end of the session, person's been talking a lot, that stresses out whatever ability they have to regulate.
It's interesting. Usually if I'm seeing somebody who's under 16, parents with them, and mothers can always hear the difference. Fathers sometimes can hear the difference. They're just not as good. But mothers can hear the difference. And if you're using something like speech as a monitoring device, you can have them track it, and that will tell you when the effect of the session is wearing off. It's a couple of days or a couple of weeks or whatever it is, because it'll deteriorate again.
So some of the things we can do are to monitor or get someone to monitor things like speech articulation to really get history. Kind of, I think what you're suggesting is sort of start broadly and then, you know, hone in on the things that are interesting, and particularly if they are transitory, if the complaints are transitory. Obviously, if they end in headache, that's a big clue that it's migraine. And to wonder about, again, with these transitory issues, could they be seizure? Could they be an inflammatory process? Can they be, there's a lot of the kind of autoimmune sorts of things that also can cause transitory issues. And I guess is what we, you know, the advantage that we have much of the time, maybe not always, is we have more time with the patient than a PCP or other medical doc will have. And so we should be, I think you said, remain skeptical.
Yeah, that's an amazing advantage. The primary care person, when I see my primary care physician, I might get 3 or 4 minutes with him. And he's a nice guy and he's very thorough, but most of the work is done by, you know, paramedical type people. And he comes in and does his thing and he's gone. And it's worse with specialists. And that's one of the things that people continually complain about when I see them, is that, you know, I was in the process of saying the next thing and the visit was gone. You know, it's just, it's the nature of medicine these days, but there's very little time with the actual specialist. So, yeah, we have a luxury of time.
As a clinician who sees a lot of health-related conditions walk through my door, it is hard to maintain that skepticism because, again, our own biases. I tend to be very skeptical when people are sent in because of anxiety, because I see that as quote, sort of a kitchen sink reason for sending people in a lot of the time. But it is also hard to maintain that skeptical approach over time. So I'm thinking about some of the folks I've worked with who come in with what they now call psychogenic, non-epileptic.
Oh, I hate this.
It's a better term than it used to be.
Oh.
So, and who eventually actually show paroxysmal.
Absolutely. ED,
and actually often do, even if they're not having, quote, seizures.
Yeah.
It's hard to keep that skepticism up. Now, I can do things like do neuro or biofeedback with them anyway.
Yeah.
Or I think about folks with PANS or PANDAS who develop symptoms of OCD and are treated with cognitive behavior therapy only. It can work. It's just a lot harder. And I think that that's also one of the things that we should keep in mind, those of us who are doing other behavioral types of treatment, is that the OCDs and the anxieties that derive from some of these medical issues, they just don't respond as well to
CBT. You've noticed that, huh?
Yeah, I have. not that we necessarily get a lot. I mean, I haven't seen that in the literature. There's very little literature out there anyway for medical-based cognitive and behavioral issues. But certainly in my experience and the experience of others who do this kind of work that I've spoken with, all anecdotal, they're just harder to change. It's harder. In a way, that's almost a clue that there's a medical issue. So I guess,
yeah,
you know, what you're saying is we should be skeptical, maintain our skepticism. What do you have any advice for what patients can do to help move things along?
It's tough. It depends on what stage they are with the seeking consulting type people, but bringing in data is useful. Like, I have these events and I'm getting them every other day. Things like that. I mean, it's nice to know how frequently, how long they last. And if they get a headache at the end of it, it's wonderful. It's terrific because it really helps. People end up in emergency rooms with stroke symptoms. Like they'll get a paralysis of one arm or something like that. And one of the emergency differential diagnoses is a person gets a headache, then you can relax a little bit.
Right.
And the symptom goes away with the headache. And that's kind of counterintuitive. That's a nice thing if it happens. Things often aren't that clean.
Yes. And I think what makes it even harder is something you alluded to earlier, which is the medical docs, the doctors, they just don't have the time.
Yeah.
And, you know, when I'm working with a patient, and I imagine you've had the same experience, trying to get through to their doctors, even if we all agree there is a medical issue, is hard enough. But then trying to get them back to a doctor to do a fuller diagnostics is very, very difficult.
You've noticed.
Yes. And so I guess all we can do is our best. And I'm sure any of us who've done this for long enough have had experiences of working with patients and then suddenly there's a medical, serious medical issue, if not an emergency, that was just missed because it was seen as psychiatric. And trying to maintain a patient's own belief in themselves, particularly in the face of the difficulties of getting into the medical system and getting appropriate diagnostics is sometimes, I think, at least half the work that I do.
You may be in better shape than I am in our region. I think you might be. When there's a need for a movement neurologist or an epileptologist, you could be looking at 6 months at a referral. And that's a long time to wait. We don't have a lot of resources here.
Well, certainly in the Boston area, there are many, many, many more resources than most other places. There's still 6 month plus waits.
Really?
Oftentimes. Sleep studies, for example, have people waiting until, you know, at least 6 months from now. And it's not just that. It's also just convincing the doctors that they should take it seriously is often difficult. And I think that reflects oftentimes that sort of, you know, the Cartesian split that we still seem to live with, that mind-body split, and that how hard it is to believe that a medical condition can really present as anxiety or as mood change. And it's not super common necessarily. I mean, I think physicians tend to do generally a good job, but those aren't the people we see. We see the people who are having trouble getting diagnostics and treatment.
Typically, yeah. I think we agree at the complexity of things. I don't have a good solution.
Well, I guess the solution, at least from our end as the providers, is just to keep skeptical and to keep skeptical of our own biases, but to maintain openness to what the patient is bringing in and the symptoms they're reporting. And that if what we're doing isn't working, it's not the patient's problem, it's the treatment and perhaps the diagnostic.
You know, you mentioned PNES. That diagnosis drives me nuts. Almost all of the folks eventually show with real seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And the psychogenic non-epileptic seizures, it just means you haven't been able to pick up the seizure activity on the surface of the head.
Right.
If somebody will drill a hole in there and use depth electrodes, they'll find it. That's kind of inconvenient.
That's one way of putting it, yes.
People don't volunteer to have a hole stuck in their head.
No. Although I've worked with people who are more or less willing to do anything,
really?
Given how long they've been suffering and how little treatment seems to help.
It's just some things I find really annoying, and that's one of them. And it's almost a steamroller. There's a whole movement for support groups for people with psychogenic seizures. My diagnosis on it is a little bit simpler. For people with convulsions, if they fall down and hit the corner of a table, it's probably a real seizure. And if they fall down and they never hurt themselves, then maybe it's psychogenic. But it's tough. I think it's an overused diagnosis. Really bothers
me. Well, yeah, and I think that there's this is what your talk is about. There's a whole host of those that are probably overused and reflect how difficult it is sometimes to pick up the signs that indicate epilepsy or something like that. Conversion disorder is another one that I still get people. It's a term that I'm surprised is still in use, but I still get people who are diagnosed with conversion disorder. And it's a tough, when I get people with PNES or conversion disorder or anything like that, I sort of think of them as These are the people with refractory conditions.
Yeah, it's a condition they adapt to that, I don't know, they're interesting. I had somebody who was senior for migraines, and it was really unrelated to migraines, but she also happened to be blind, but wasn't. It was strictly a psychogenic blindness. She never bumped into things. And the way we ended up treating it was to have her sister walk with her on the side of the road, with cars zipping by. And eventually it just interfered with the blindness. She could see again. But I don't know, these psychogenic symptoms, they often are diagnosed as psychogenic and they shouldn't be. That one happened.
That one happened to be, and that's I think where a lot of us feel the need to be really careful is, well, what is it really? Because just we've been primarily talking about the times when folks come in and with psychiatric diagnoses, but there's really a medical condition. But there's an example of, again, to be too Cartesian about it, the other way around.
Yeah. It makes life interesting.
It does make life interesting. Well, Jeff, thank you so much for joining us here today. We are looking forward to your webinar, which we'll have a link in the show notes, or you can go to nrbs.org. And this is a free webinar on May the 17th.
Well, it's been a pleasure, as it always is. Good to see you again.
And you too.
You are listening to Healthy Brain, Happy Body. I'm your host, Dr. Saul Rosenthal. Our guide today was Dr. Jeff Carman, developer of the PIR-HEG neurofeedback system, and expert in brain-based medical conditions that affect behavior, mood, and cognitive status. You can find a free recording of his webinar by clicking on the register link in the show notes or at nrbs.org. Subscribe to this podcast by clicking the Subscribe Here link or wherever you get your podcasts. If you enjoy it, please subscribe, rate us, and leave reviews at Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Reviews help us get to more listeners, and that's more people who can learn about and benefit from biofeedback, neurofeedback, and other mind-to-body approaches to health. Also, let us know what you think by sending us email. Our address is healthybrain@nrbs.org. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is produced and edited by me. The theme music is Catch It by Coma Media. It is a production of the Northeast Region Biofeedback Society. Go to nrbs.org to find out more about the organization, including our trainings, monthly webinars, and yearly conference. All opinions expressed are those of our guests and not the NRBS. This podcast is not meant to replace advice from qualified healthcare providers. Healthy Brain, Happy Body is supported by the sponsors of NRBS, including Old Barn Technologies, who is sponsoring Jeff's talk, and by the International Society for Neuroregulation and Research. Be sure to join us on our next episode as we continue to explore the keys to our well-being on Healthy Brain, Happy Body.